Welcome to On Tour with Sports 24. I'm Emma Saunders and this is your guide to the world's most iconic sporting cities. Each episode we'll be heading to a different part of the world to give you an inside view into what makes it a sporting city. So we're going to be finding out what the locals recommend to get a real flavour of its sports and culture and what you should experience when you come to visit. It's what Sport 24 is all about, a sports channel that connects onboard passengers to those unmissable live sporting moments. So whether you're flying at 35,000 feet or relaxing on your ocean cruise, you can be watching the game live. Sounds like the only way to travel, so buckle up and sit back. You're listening to On Tour with Sport 24.
Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Sport 24, we'd like to welcome you to Paris.
Yes, for this episode, we're in the city of love, Paris. And as always, joining me for this leg of our journey is travel TikToker extraordinaire, Rob Adcock. Hi, Rob. Well, should I say bonjour? It is called the city of love. Is Paris the place to fall in love with if you're a sports fan?
It would seem so, wouldn't it? Everywhere you look, when you're looking at Paris for sport, it seems like there's something going on. There's obviously going to go through it in the podcast, but it is the place. And also, Emma, as we know, if you listen to these podcasts, you'll know that we love our food and it doesn't get much better than that. So for us, it is pretty much the perfect place.
Yeah, I'm thinking pastries, Rob. Yeah. Even without the sport, I think that's enough of a pull there.
Yeah, what I love about this podcast is it is obviously all about sport, but within seconds we start talking about food and other things to do. So it is literally the perfect place for it.
Just as an overview then, sport in Paris, what does it have to offer?
Yeah, you've got the French Open tennis, Roland Garros. Obviously, a lot of people around the world will know it for the Tour de France as well. That is the big stage finish right at the end there. You speak to cyclists who've taken part in that and they'll talk about that at length, about how passionate the people are there and what a spectacular ending as well. When you look at it on the screen or if you're lucky enough to be there, that finish for the Tour de France is amazing. If you think back to 2012 and you think about Bradley Wiggins' achievements, it is unbelievable. And of course, PSG, Paris Saint-Germain. When you talk about football, they are one of the big forces in European football at the moment. So, yeah, loads of things to do.
Not only that, Paris, once again, very much in the centre of the sporting world with the 2023 Rugby World Cup and the small matter of the Olympic Games in 2024.
For me, I cannot wait for the Olympic Games in 2024. I'm going to be going. I cannot wait. We're going to be doing that and the Paralympics, and it is going to be... Whenever the Olympic Games takes place is always amazing, and the city always comes around for it, and it's an unbelievable thing. But being in Paris is just going to be amazing.
Well, yes, whenever any of these huge sporting events come to a city, there's always a mighty transformation. But don't take our word for it. We need a local to give us the proper tour of the city. So who better than sports journalist, broadcaster and Parisian Julien Laurent? Hello.
Bonjour. Ça va bien? Et toi?
Yeah, that's the end of my French vocabulary, which is why we've got you here, actually, to take us on a virtual guided tour that I think also helped with some of the pronunciations today and a bit of the local lingo.
No problem at all.
But tell us about Paris then. Why should people visit? You're born and bred.
Yes. I mean, I'm obviously completely biased, right? I have to say it, because it is the best city in the world. And you've got everything. Rob said it a little bit, you too, Emma as well. You've got stadiums for whatever sports you like, whether it's football, basketball, rugby, horse racing, tennis, golf even. The Ryder Cup was there not so long ago, or just outside of the capital. So whatever sports you're after, there's there. Judo, if you want. Karate, if you want. Boxing, regularly. You've got the NBA coming, the basketball every year. You've got really everything in Paris. And yet the French are not fanatical about sports. This is not what we do. However, Paris as a city has everything to make any sports lover very happy.
That's really interesting you should say that. So by your own admission, it isn't historically a place. I mean, the Parisians themselves don't love sport, but it's still become this sporting hub. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, you're right. For example, you watch Roland Garros, the tennis, and you will very, very often see empty seats. in the afternoon because the French lunch is very important for us in Paris. So you have lunch, and only then, even if Novak Djokovic is playing or Carlos Alcaraz or Rafael Nadal, only then you go and take your seat to watch the game of the afternoon that you've got a ticket for. And it's the same, it's a very demanding crowd because we would only go to sporting event if it was better than what you can see at the theater or the cinema or the gig or an exhibition. This is how the Parisians treat sports in general, you know?
Well, you'd probably say they've got their priorities right, wouldn't you? If they're going to get some lunch instead.
And a restaurant, yeah.
I've literally just written down, lunch is very important. And it's just like, yep, I'm all over it.
On a serious note, though, I mean, that's music to the ears of tourists coming to Paris because it means there's probably ample opportunity for them to be able to get seats inside these sporting venues, yeah.
So, yes, although we like having a seat, we like having a ticket, even if we miss the beginning of a tennis match, for example, or something. But, I mean, yeah, it's not too difficult to get tickets for what you want in Paris if you get organized and plan it before. If you don't go for too much of a big game, for example, if it's in football for PSG or even for the French national team, rugby, football, whatever, it depends. But if you get organized and get in early, you should be okay.
Well, we'll be speaking a bit more about the tennis and Roland Garros in a bit, but we will start by focusing on the two biggest sporting arenas in Paris, which will both host events at the 2024 Olympics. So the Stade de France is France's national stadium and will host athletics and the rugby sevens at the Olympics, whilst Parc des Princes will host football. So let's start there, Jules. You're a PSG fan, yeah, aren't you? It's not really a secret.
No.
Why? What is it about the club that you love so much, other than, of course, geographically it being effectively your local team?
Yeah, and for a big city like Paris, this is the only team in the top flight. In London, for example, you've got many in the Premier League. In Milan, you've got many. In Madrid, you've got a few as well. So usually big cities means have big football clubs in your top flight wherever you live. It's not really the case for us. So the appeal is bigger, wider. There's Paris FC or Red Star who are, you know, other teams in Paris, but not as good as PSG, of course. But the Parc des Princes, I just think that it's really rare to have a stadium right in the, almost in the city centre, like this one in the 16th arrondissement. If you think about stadiums, you know, in all the big cities, they're usually a bit outside of the city centre. This one is right there. I think that's what makes it so beautiful, outside of the architecture that is brilliant too. But the fact that it's just there, almost on your doorstep, is even better.
I love the fact that now everywhere you go, it seems like anywhere in the world, you'll see PSG merchandise, you'll see people wearing training tops or shirts and things like that. Does it feel like the club has got so much bigger over the last couple of years?
Yeah, Rob, 100%. Yeah, in the last even maybe 10 years. Sometimes it feels like it's become too much of a marketing tool more than a football team, because like you say, you see a lot of people wearing the shirt or the tops and everything all around the world, and I would rather the team to be a bit more successful than just selling shirts or merchandising. But yeah, you're right, they've become a huge powerhouse certainly in terms of the image that they have and how much people like wearing the stuff, which is great. And they, PSG, have opened a shop in London, for example. There's no other clubs, not even London clubs have a shop on Oxford Street, but PSG have one. So this is the planet that they're on now, which I think is great. And the Parc des Princes feel very much like this is where it all started. This is where they are. It feels really like the home of this team.
There's never been any shortage of superstars in that PSG team, certainly not in recent history. So how much of a pull do you think is playing in Paris to the players that are coming over as well?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's a selling point of the club. You know, you come to play for PSG, but you live in Paris. A lot of those superstars want that. You also, you could see in the stands, because you always have like superstars at the Parc des Princes watching the team, even for not really good games. But Beyoncé and Jay-Z or Michael Jordan was there last season. David Beckham was there last season. So you've got all those big names coming because they're in Paris, because they come for the city first maybe. And then if they're in the city, if they're in town, they go to watch PSG or something else. But that's the glamour of the city as well. That appeal is very, very important.
Take us through a match day then in Paris when PSG are playing. what does it typically look like for a fan? Is it up in the morning, a coffee and a croissant, or am I just stereotyping there?
No, you're good. Although we don't have like 3 p.m. kickoffs that you can have in England, for example. So PSG very often play in the evening, so which is good. You've got the whole day, a bit of a lay-in, and have your pastries in bed, breakfast in bed. It's all good. And then you start making your way to the ground maybe mid-afternoon. There's lovely cafes, like Paris cafe style, around the stadium. So at the Porte d'Auteuil, towards Boulogne as well. So all around the Parc des Princes, you go and get a coffee around 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. You've got a couple of you've got big PSG shops right in front of the stadium, for example. And then you go in. The tube has loads of stops around the stadium. It's more difficult to park if you're driving, but if you take public transport, it's quite easy access. And then the atmosphere, usually at the Parc des Princes, is very special. The PSG ultras are really, really good fans.
I love the level of detail that you go into as well. So if you're going to park, it might be difficult to park. This is what you get on this podcast. This is the level of detail. This is why we love it. If you just rocked up in Paris and PSG were playing the next day, for example, how easy or difficult would it be to get tickets?
You might be able, depending on the game and the opposition, you might be able still to get a ticket the day before. Maybe on like those websites who resell tickets for people who cannot go, for example. Otherwise, you need to get organized because it's a 45,000-seater stadium. They can usually sell 60 or 70, 80,000 for each game. So it's too small of a stadium almost for the demand of tickets. But you can still get some. I would say, if you target a smaller game, if I can talk like that, or maybe even a cup game, you'll have more chances, obviously, than a Champions League game against Manchester City, for example, or those kind of top Barcelona, or those kind of top clubs, Real Madrid. So, yeah, get organised. Maybe pick your game wisely if you're planning to travel. But you should be able to get some. Maybe a bit expensive, because that's also the case, that those tickets are quite expensive.
With travelling, I know you've mentioned there's parking, which is very useful, but typically, do people use... It's the metro, isn't it, in Paris? So how much is that used as a network across the city?
Yeah, massively. It's everywhere. It's, I think, the oldest metro in the world. It's very good, although maybe a bit slow at times. Although you've got reception for your phone, not like in the... Like everywhere on the tube, you know, not
no
just...
No excuses
that
why you've been ignoring my calls, Angels.
Exactly.
Is that really?
And your messages. I mean, Rob, I would... You know. That's good. And I would advise people to go to the Parc des Princes or anywhere, really, with public transport, because parking... My dad used to have like a cheeky parking spot when we were younger to go to the stadium, but really... It's still a surprise how the car never got tucked away. So yeah, don't drive. Take the public transport, it's better.
Okay, so I could take the metro. Could I to Stade de France as well?
Yeah, you'd have to take the overground as well.
Right.
After.
And tell us about that stadium. How does it differ to the one we were just talking about?
Well, this one is more of a traditional stadium in a big city, which is outside of the city centre, even outside of Paris, because technically the Stade de France is in Saint-Denis, not in Paris itself. But it's literally just on the outskirts of the city. It's much bigger. It's almost twice the size of the Parc des Princes. It's much newer because it was built in 1998. The opening game was January 1998, when Zidane and France won 1-0 against Spain. And it's got an athletic track around, so if it doesn't really feel like a football ground, to be fair, or a rugby ground for the matter. But it's huge, it's big. France have great memories there, of course. But it does feel a little bit you're outside of Paris. It's not the same experience than the Parc des Princes, where you very much still feel within the city.
It's not just hosted lots of events for World Cup 98 as well, as it more recently it's been the big host for many things.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, not long after the 98 World Cup, we had the Athletics World Championship in 2003, which was big because the stadium was full and it was an amazing week. And then, yes, of course, you had the Euros in 2016. The Rugby World Cup was there as well. And the Olympics will obviously, it would be the heart of the Olympic. The Olympic Village won't be too far from the stadium either in Saint-Denis. So there would be a lot of things to look at and to do around the Olympics too.
Well, you touched on it there, some iconic moments that have happened inside these stadiums, but what about for you and your personal experience?
I mean, the Parc des Princes is very, very special to me because my first game ever was there in 1984, so a long time ago, before you were even born, Emma, against Vito Auton, so like the Hungarian team. I played at the Parc des Princes in the Paris Cup final when I was 15. Yeah, we got beaten by PSG with my team.
Can we just that was a lovely, that's the best little drop of information yeah. we've had
ever on this
podcast. Not
too many of our guests can say that. Yeah.
let's just go more into that, please.
Yeah, I mean, it's the, just the at the time, I don't think it's the case anymore, but when you were in the final of the Paris Cup, so all the grassroots teams in the whole of Paris and the suburbs and the banlieue all around would have this big like tournament, like the FA Cup, basically. And then when you played in the final, you would play at the Parc des Princes just before the men's team. And we faced, my team was Vincennes at the time in the Val-de-Marne, so 94, like kind of east suburbs of the capital. And we played the PSG team, who had a couple of players who then went on to become professional. But it was there, it was just before a PSG Marty game in April 95, I think it was. I think my dad still has the ticket at home. And it was amazing because we got changed in the dressing room. Pitch
what
was
it
amazing.
Like? The tunnel? Yeah, take us inside.
It was just wonderful. We got through the entrance of the players' entrance. So it really felt like, you know, everybody had the music on, like if we were literally PSG players.
The wash bag,
you know. And my hair was so nicely done. I think you were allowed to bring 4 or 5 people with you. So we pretended before the game that we were looking in the stand and see mum and dad, brothers, sisters, cousins. All of that. Like literally.
The full experience.
Yeah, and then
yeah.
we were 2-0 down after 10 minutes. So the reality got back. But it was just, I think apart from playing there, where like the people obviously I idolized, played before, and having the family in the stand was very special, even if we lost. But it just, the pitch felt so big and it was just the normal size. But I think with the stands all above, obviously none of us had ever played in a stadium like that. So it was very special. Yeah, so we still have the photos and some of my mates actually from that team recently sent me quite a few more photos of that day, which was very, very special. So yeah, it was great. And I always dreamt to play at the Parc des Princes. And that day, the dream, and that's the only time I ever did. So that day, the dream was realised.
Wow.
I love how he tells that story so nonchalantly as well. Like my reference of playing football at a stadium is playing down at Leek Eye on a Thursday night.
That's good as well.
Very similar backdrops.
Yeah, I mean, it started as a throwaway anecdote, didn't it? Hang on a minute, you've what? Yeah. Well, what about you then, Rob? Can you say that you've played at any of these pitches, or what are your memories of these iconic sporting stadiums?
I'm yet to play at the Stade de France, but I've not given up just yet.
It's never too late.
Exactly. When I think of the Stade de France, I think of, I don't know why, I've just got a really strange, vivid memory of, was it the place where Brazil beat Scotland on the opening day of the 98 World Cup? Was that there?
That's right, yeah, 2-1, yeah.
Yeah, that was like Roberto Carlos, Rivaldo, Ronaldo, all those kind of players, wasn't it?
Yeah. Obviously, Brazil played the first game of that 98 World Cup, like you said, against Scotland at the Stade de France, and the last game, the final against France in the same place. And obviously, they lost that one 3-0. There was the whole Ronaldo saga, and the French were just amazing in that final. Zinedine Zidane, of course, who never scored headers in his life, scored 2 in that game to give France their first ever World Cup. And what was an incredible moment. Every French person, I think, from, I don't know, 8 years old onwards would remember where they were that night, whether you were at the stadium, watching on television, watching it with friends, outside, whatever. But that night, July 12th, 1998, I think would be forever remembered as like, whoa, yeah, that was very, very special.
Well, rugby also plays a central part at the Stade de France. The stadium hosted the 2007 and 2023 Rugby World Cup finals. I am delighted to say that the former professional rugby player Johnny Beat is joining us. Johnny, hello. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you very much. For you, obviously, you were playing in Scotland before you made the move to France in general. What first attracted you to go out to France to play your rugby?
Sunshine, would it be that simple? I don't know, coming from Glasgow, watching European rugby growing up, there was always this vision on TV of blue skies and rugby not being played in the rain, which attracted me. I also spent a lot of time in France in campsites with my family as a youngster, so saw firsthand. We were there for the 1998 Football World Cup, their love of sport, their passion for food, and just the good nature of the people. So there's lots of different things that drew me to France, and then the opportunity came up. Fabien Galthié asked me to come and join his side Montpellier. He's now the French national coach. That was back in 2012, and I haven't left since. Still here, living here. Kids are all born here, and we love it. Great part of the world.
Everyone we speak to when we're talking about France always mentions the food. So I'm glad that you are confirming that we are correct, that the Paris is the center of the world when it comes to food. That's okay.
It's magic. And there is something for everyone. Like every different city, you know, be it Lyon, be it Marseille, Nice, Paris, every different city, Toulouse, they all have the different specialities. So Paris is wonderful. It's got absolutely everything, but every other city you dip into as well has got something to offer. Not just the food, the wine is also not bad. nice to encourage the mix. But yeah, there's a reason why France is famous for its food and its drink, because it's absolutely phenomenal.
Paris itself then, for you going as a professional sports person whenever you played there, what was it like?
As a city in general, we didn't get to see much. It's only since retiring that I've been able to see the city, now filming and doing bits, previewing this World Cup. Did a little tour with Finn Russell, Yannick Nyanga and Wan Imhoff. The sheer scale of the place and the beauty, so the monuments, the architecture, the bistros, the terraces, there's just something for you to do in every different corner. And Paris is almost like a hodgepodge of little villages where you get different feels, different quartiers, as they call them. And so there really is something for everybody. That's the beauty of it. The food, the drink, the people, the buzz, just the sort of general ambiance is absolutely magic.
You mentioned the Football World Cup back in 1998 and, of course, the Rugby World Cup in 2023, and this could be the Paris 2024 Olympics. What is Paris like and how does it transform for these massive events?
Well, they're no stranger. The Rugby World Cup final, knockout phases, opening game, Champions League games, Champions League finals have been played there, the previous Rugby World Cup in 2007, 1998. So they've hosted pretty much everything. Athletics has been held there as well. But I'm not sure if it's Paris, just France in general. They just get a buy-in, no matter what sporting event it is. For the opening game of the Rugby World Cup, they had 17.5 million people watch the game on television. And then they have the sort of big screens around the city. They sort of transform themselves. The city, no matter where it is, if it's parks, if it's bars, if it's restaurants, they all buy in and you get that citywide. And in a city as large as Paris, that is quite rare, but somehow they manage to turn out in numbers and get behind their sporting sides and the events they hold. It doesn't matter where you are in Paris, that's what people are talking about. Even though the Moulin Rouge is going on and there's X, Y, and Z, they've got so many different things and events. Sport is always at the forefront of their mind.
I really want to talk to you about the Stade de France, because obviously you played there for Scotland. You've worked there as well. I want to talk to you about the difference between those. Let's start with playing there. What's it like? How is it like getting into the dressing rooms? Talk me through it all.
The changing rooms aren't too different. And the sort of changing rooms they are a little bit different. Normally in other stadiums, you sort of arrive at the front door of a stadium. With the Stade de France, you take the bus and you almost go down into like the belly of the stadium. You go under the stadium, which is quite different. You then have to sort of emerge to come out. It is quite gladiatorial, come out and emerge onto the pitch. That's one point of difference. And then there's just something about France, the Stade de France and the noise levels. I think most other countries are quite polite. I'm not sure that's the right word, but it's quite quiet. You know, you play rugby and if you're in Edinburgh or London, you know, it's a party atmosphere, but generally it's quite quiet, where French rugby in general is a party. So there's noise, there's brass bands, there's volume, and that hits you as soon as you walk out for the warm-up. So that's the sort of point of difference you get at the Stade de France. It's a wee bit more in your face, and the French fans are always up for it. So it's definitely different, and that makes it intimidating, because if you don't start well and you don't play well, French fans really quickly get onto their team, the noise levels go up again, and everything becomes harder for your side. So psychologically, it's quite a difficult place to go away and play rugby.
I always wondered this. So you know when you're on that bus and you're dropping down into the Stade de France and it's obviously different, do you notice a difference on the team bus? So like the other players, can you see them going to the shallow there, or how does it kind of compare?
I don't know, everyone's different in their match day routine. I mean, some people are now so used to it. We saw Antoine Dupont, who's an old teammate of mine from CAS, now playing at Toulouse, and he's one of the best rugby players on the planet at the minute. We saw him having a nap. So for him, doesn't change anything. Cool as a cucumber, closing his eyes, getting 40 winks before the biggest rugby game that any of us have ever seen. It was the biggest and most viewed game that we've ever had. So for him, it doesn't seem to change much. And I think most people, you try to remove those external pressures, as difficult as that is, and just focus on the performance aspect. What's your job? What's the job at hand? And what's your next task? Which is easier said than done, but that is the sort of nature of professional rugby. You try to strip all those things away, but you can't help but notice, right? Even these simple little things about going into the belly of a stadium, or points of differences, or just taking it in as you go in, because you want to enjoy the experience. You can't be a robot 24/7. So I just enjoyed it. Wherever you were going, whatever platform you were offered the chance to play on, you try to absorb it and then use it. So for the Stade de France, that was one of the things I really enjoyed, the noise. Maybe for other people, that might be intimidating and it would force them to go into their shell, but I enjoy being part of that experience, being able to interact with fans. And if there's a positive action, you know, that noise spurs you on to another positive action. And conversely, if there's something negative that happens and there's a big boo or a whistle, which you get at the Stade de France, that can force you the other way. And also, the Stade de France has kicked on. When I played, the French team maybe wasn't at the level it is now. When you go now, there is this expectation, there's this belief, and the atmosphere is absolutely rampant. Like, I can't think of another word. It's just, it's so high. Everybody is so pumped, ready to watch the French team, because they've got a side back that they didn't have maybe 10 years ago. They truly believe in the sporting capabilities, the coaching team, and now they really do have a team that can play. So you go there now and you experience one of the best atmospheres in world rugby.
Just finally, Jules is a guest on the podcast this time round, said that lunch is very important. So for you, obviously you spent a lot of time in France, a lot of time in Paris. If you're going to go to one place while you're in Paris, where are you going?
Ooh.
We like to put you on the spot on this podcast. That's the main thing you need to take away from this, Johnny.
Well, I mean, don't get me wrong. I completely agree. Lunch is very, very important. especially if you're talking pre-match meal and getting a wee bit lubricated before getting to the stadium. I mean, there's typical plates, but I mean, like, generally, the beauty of Paris, or the beauty of France in general, is you can go to pretty much any bistro and go for a menu of the day, and you get a starter, a main, a dessert, maybe a glass of wine and a coffee for €13, and it'll blow your mind. Compared to what you would get in, like, I'm from the UK, compare that to what you'd get for your money in the UK, it will blow your mind. The quality of food and gastronomy in Paris is absolutely phenomenal. So it might be a steak tartare, it might be the simplicity of a baguette. There are so many different things that you can pick up, like their meat, the way they cook their meat, their entrecote and chip. I mean, basic, simple stuff. But you can go anywhere and select anything, and it will be exceptional. And in terms of places that I've been, one place that I was taken to by an old rugby mate, Yannick Nyanga, used to play for the French side. We last had lunch together in Paris, maybe middle of June. He took me to a new place called Monsieur Bleu, and it was insane. They had everything on the menu, really good quality. We were sat right behind Emma Watson, actress from Harry Potter as well, which is a good celebrity spot if you're into that kind of thing. But the food was really, really good. So there's one place that I didn't know that I would definitely recommend. And it's a second-hand recommendation. It's really from Yannick Nyanga.
I'll stick it on the list. Johnny Beattie, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Pleasure, mate.
Well, great to get an insight into a major event in Paris, such as the 2023 Rugby World Cup. Now, Rob, you've been busy doing your research. As in every episode, we want to give you, the listener, the best tips about our chosen city, all in one handy list. So whether that be places to grab a pre-match drink, have a bite to eat, or simply somewhere you just have to visit, it is time for our Paris Tourist Top 5.
At number five, now we can sit here all day and say, don't go and do the touristy stuff. And I know this list is always the exact opposite of what that's about. But for me, some point, if you're going to go to Paris, ultimately, you're going to go and see the Eiffel Tower. It's going to happen. We can sit here and say all the other stuff, but that is going to happen. So I've got a recommendation for you for the best place to get that mint photo for your Insta, Emma. It's called Rue de l'Université. No, I'm not half French. I know that most people listening will think that near perfect pronunciation must mean that he spent half his life in Paris. But no, go to this place just as the sun is rising and you'll get that photograph, which will pop off on your stories and it will look mwah, chef's kiss.
Jules, has that made an appearance on your Instagram feed, that particular camera angle?
Yeah, can you say the street again, Rod?
Yeah, sure. I don't know. It's Rue de l'Université. You have to really... pronunciation.
Yeah, slightly aggressive that, but yeah, no, this is, to be fair, this is perfect. Yeah, you get the perfect photo there.
At number four, now I know the idea of going to an open air market will divide listeners, it will divide opinion. Some will say it's like what Linda from accounts will do on a half-term plans, but I've got one that you will love. It's called Granelle Market and it has got everything. And the food, oh, it's about as French as you can get. The setting is brilliant and it just has everything you could ever want from a market. Now it's only open on certain days, so check before you go. Check before you travel, as you say, on anything that's touristy related. You will not be disappointed. And it gets extra points for me because it is free.
Jules, you usually like your fine dining, don't you? But what about what Rob just said there, the market?
Yeah, in Grenelle. And it's a lovely area, loads of restaurants as well. There's a very delicious Corsican restaurant on Boulevard de Grenelle, by the way. My mum used to love the Marché d'Aligre, which is a little bit more towards the Seine, so towards the river, if you think about in Grenelle where you are. But again, like, the smell is great. There's a flower market not nearby as well. So this one is great. And if you like antiques, talking about markets and marché, you obviously have the Antiquaires, who are in Saint-Ouen, so a bit north of the city, just outside again the peripheric and the outskirts, but great antique there too.
At number three, staying on the theme of free, which is always a sentence that I love to say, if you're looking for that one view where you see everything, you know, that panoramic view, which is just on a gorgeous evening, the sun is setting, the city's glowing, I've got you covered. Soukaker is a place to be. Yeah, pick me up on that one, Jules. Beautiful pronunciation there. Now, on a clear day, you can see up to 40 kilometres away. It's going to be busy, so don't blame me for that one. I can't even begin to believe and think about how many people you'll see proposing up there. The next time I get married, that is going to be on the list of places that I will get down on one knee for.
Yeah, so that's Sacré-Cœur, yes, for the correct real pronunciation. Yeah, exactly. But with the Stoke accent, you know, we got you there. Although Emma went, you know, she could hardly remember the name.
Just to give some context.
She just said, like, some steps and then you go quite high. Okay, yeah, Montmartre, Sacré-Cœur.
Yeah, I have, as Jules just said there, been there, done this, and it's an awful lot of steps. And yes, it was quite busy, Rob, but my goodness me, you're not wrong. The view at the top was, to use your phrase, mwah, chef's kiss.
At number two.
Sacré bleu, I should say.
At number two, it's never going to be long in one of these lists until we mention food. I don't know what to tell you. I am nothing if not predictable. And if it's a bakery, well, that's just enough to make me giddy. And Mamach is a place for that. Now, you can give it a little Google, just cakes and bread. I'm not even going to describe just how good they look, but they're known for the cookies, and I'm not a hater, so don't get on at me for this, don't at me, don't mention me, but if it's not doughy and stodgy, for me, it's not worth visiting. But this bakery has got all the cakes, all the carbs, and believe me, you will love it. It's pronounced Mamach. Mamach. Again,
do you want to write this down, Jules? Just writes a spit off his laptop screen.
write these ones down, Jules. You'll need these when you get back home next.
The problem, Rob, is that every corner of a street, you've got a boulangerie in Paris that makes amazing pastries that Emma loves and that we all do, to be fair. And the first thing she said when I arrived, said, "Where are my macarons?" I was like, I mean, come on, like, you know, but yeah. Same with the macarons, you can find them, obviously, a very Parisian things, and La Durée, for example, do some amazing ones. So next time, I promise, I'll bring some for you and Rob.
Got that on record, I'm afraid, with this being a podcast.
For all the producers as well. I want to come back on the show, so I'll bribe you with some macarons.
Final one then, at number one. I'm going to squeeze three things in here because I couldn't pick just one favourite one, okay? So I'm going to chuck them all at you now. The best non-touristy things to do, there is something called Line 40. It's like this little mini bus that goes all over Montmartre, so you don't have to walk up and down the hills. But that, if you jump on that, you'll see loads of different things there. This other list, should we call this 1B? Yeah, let's go with 1B. If you ever sit by the Canal Saint-Martin, really peaceful in the morning, really calm. But then later on at night, people turn up with guitars and beer at night. It's quite nice. And 1C, you didn't think we'd get to this level of detail, did you? If you walk along the Promenade Plantée, it's inspired the New York High Line. So it's just an amazing place to be.
Yeah, that's a perfect 1A, B and C, I think.
That's that. So I didn't know if you were talking about the buses you can get, the 1A, the 1B and the 1C.
Oh my God.
And if you've just been or are planning a trip to Paris, then we'd love to hear any of your travel hints and tips and see your pictures and videos. You can follow Sport24 on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram and use the hashtag MySport24 to get in touch. Now, on to another Paris sporting venue that will play a vital role at the 2024 Olympics, Roland Garros. Tennis broadcaster Marcus Buckland has been guiding us around the home of French tennis, host of the annual Grand Slam, the French Open.
Well, bonjour from Paris, the city of love, light, and certainly in this area, sport. Our 12-minute walk from the hotel to Roland-Garros takes us past the Parc des Princes, home to Ligue 1 champions Paris Saint-Germain. Next door to that is the Stade Français, which hosts top-quality rugby union. For a spot of horse racing, it's a short walk to Auteuil. And for tennis lovers, every fortnight in late May and early June, all roads lead to the home of the French Open, which is my destination now. The site itself has been expanded and modernised beyond recognition in recent years. I'm currently sitting in the Jardin des Mousquetaires among hundreds of people lapping up the sunshine on deck chairs, watching the giant screens, eating some mouth-watering sandwiches and patisseries, and washing those down with a variety of refreshing drinks. It's a perfect scene that provides indelible memories for so many.
I'm Sophie Amiac, former number five player in France. Oh, this place gets a lot of, a lot of heart, a lot of memories and experience. I actually lived at Roland Garros when this site was not even close to what it looks like today. You have to remember that the main two sports here are football, soccer, and tennis. And, I think we're the second sport, and I think that for the French people, a lot of people in this country, play tennis and love to play singles. They play singles at all ages and very late in their, in their life, which is phenomenal to watch. I think the French are, they become the player. They feel the player and then they become them. They are part of it. They are part of the history.
There are three main courts here. Philippe Chatrier is the centrepiece, named after the famed former player and administrator. Court Suzanne Longlen, like Chatrier, will have a roof when Paris hosts the Olympics. I've made my way to the magical Simone Mathieu, an intimate court which, from the outside, resembles a greenhouse and is set amidst wild flowers and a delightful orangery. It's wonderful on the eye. And given the right conditions, Roland Garros is, without question, a photographer's delight.
Hi, I'm Ella Ling. I'm a freelance photographer and I specialise in tennis. A particular favourite time of the day for me is as the sun starts to go down behind Philippe Chatrier at around 7 p.m. and the shadow starts to move across the court. So with the sun still hitting the player and the dappled dark shadow as a backdrop, this is our time to play. And there are some particular photo spots that are unique to Paris. La Fosse is a favourite. It's the only tournament in the world where we can shoot from underground at the back of the court. And I'll be there, courtside, to capture it all.
Bottom line is that Roland Garros ticks so many boxes. You've got passion, beauty, elegance, top quality sport, lots of good food. Plenty of fine wine. If you come here, you'll definitely have a very good time. It's time for me to go and have one of those refreshing drinks. Santé!
Yes, I can vouch for that as well. Refreshing drinks are a must. The year that I went to Roland Garros, it was stinking hot, well up in the 30s. The court temperature on Philippe Chatrier, you need one of those handheld fans at the very least. I mean, we heard there from Marcus, it ticks a number of boxes in his words, Jules. But for you, what does the French Open tennis offer?
For me, I think it's an amazing experience, really. If you can go, it's the colour, because the clay is obviously has that burgundy colour. Plus the stadium is white and you've got the green of the trees and the flowers everywhere. And I think the contrast of them, or if it's on the sunny day, like you said, when you went, it's just an incredible experience. And I think the atmosphere is special because, like you said, the Paris crowd is demanding. And like we said earlier, they almost demand good tennis. Otherwise, they're not happy. You need the fan. It's so hot. You need the hat as well. Everybody has their hat and the glasses. And then the superstars. We don't have like a royal box like you have in Wimbledon, for example. But we have boxes full of superstars usually during the whole 2 weeks of the tournament.
Yeah, because whilst we're talking about the weather conditions, it usually happens in May, doesn't it? And what kind of temperatures are normal for that time of year? I don't know if I was just there on a particularly hot day when it was well up in the 30 degrees. But
I went last year, it was really hot as well. Really? So I think it depends very much. But as we heard Marcus saying, they have a roof now. They will have the roof on the Châtrier and the roof on the Long Lane courts, because there have been years where it rained a lot as well, even in May in Paris. So you just never know. But again, if you plan, if you want, if your dream is to go to Roland Garros, get in early, you get like almost like a raffle ticket prices that you can get, hopefully. Otherwise, you can buy some. They're not cheap, but it's really worth it because it's a special experience.
I think Rob's got a question for in a moment. But just whilst we're talking tickets, in my experience, I think you're right. There is some kind of ballot service, a bit like Wimbledon, but I'm sure I just went online. I think it was like a sort of Ticketmaster operation where the day that the tickets are released, you can sign up to these email addresses that let you know which day, so you can be ready. And when they are released at sort of 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, it's like getting tickets for Beyonce concert to reference her again. You have to get there and then you're told you are number 1,000 or something in the queue. And then you have to patiently wait and keep your fingers crossed that you can get tickets for the show courts. But even if you don't, actually, it's like Wimbledon. You can sort of, and any of the Grand Slams, you can mooch around the outside courts as well.
Very true.
And actually, I did, that's what I liked about it. It wasn't as overwhelming. It's amazing as the grounds of Wimbledon are. There's a lot of walking, whereas it felt like it was a bit more intimate in Paris at Roland Garros. But fire away, Rob. I know you've got a question for Jules.
We were talking about the London version of this podcast. You mentioned Wimbledon. For the London version of this podcast, we presented it from Wimbledon. One of the things that I really enjoyed about that was all the different traditions that you've got, all the special things that you wouldn't really get anywhere else. What is Roland Garros' version of that?
Yeah, it's a good question. We don't have like the everybody.
Strawberries and cream. What's your version?
We don't have the Pims either. It's just more of the usual thing, if you can say, really. But it still feels like a special occasion, even if there's nothing really special in terms of food or drinks that you can get there that you can't get anywhere else. But just to go back slightly, what Emma was just saying, the difference maybe Wimbledon, if it still feels kind of far away maybe from London. Roland Garros is at Port d'Auteuil, which is in the poshest, maybe the poshest part of Paris, near the Parc des Princes. So we heard Marcus saying, and the Stade Jean Bouin, where the Stade Français rugby team plays. So he still feels quite in the city centre of Paris, which obviously then you'll have all the assets that you can have in the city centre, like great restaurant, great boulangerie for all your pastries, Emma, and all of that. So on that, there's nothing really special in it that you can't find outside of Roland Garros, but you still feel very much in the Paris city centre.
That is obviously the top end when it comes to tennis. What's it like for grassroots? How many kind of courts are there around Paris? Is it something that's quite accessible?
Yeah, very accessible. So that's the other big difference between Paris and London. Same for the football pitches. There's a lot of football pitches all around Paris, and same with the tennis clubs and the tennis courts. You've got loads and loads everywhere. I don't really know why you find them more in Paris than in London, but if you drive on the Parc des Princes, pretty much in every port, so every exit of the peripheric, which is this big ring road that you have all around Paris, you will see football pitches and tennis courts, tennis clubs all around. So they're very, very popular, very frequent.
I noticed that actually where Roland Garros was, in that walk from the metro up to the gate that we were heading to enter the grounds, there was a number of sort of astroturfs, and there was football going on, there were tennis courts. It felt like it was a bit of an epicentre for sport even just there.
Yeah, and that's the thing. As I said earlier, we're not fanatical about sports in the sense that we would send 15,000 to watch France play in Australia, for example. However, it's a very sporty city, and a lot of people do a lot of sport. Not so much like go in the gym and do that kind of fitness work, but play tennis, play football, all of that. You've got pitches literally all around the city, and because it's big, if you count the banlieue, everywhere in the banlieue as well, you've got those kind of facilities.
Well, we've mentioned there the sort of accessibility for the general public and the sporting appetite across the city and the opportunities and the places in which you can play sport. So looking ahead to the Olympics then, 2024, and the places that will be turned into sporting venues, GCSE French has served me well so far, but Place de la Concorde, Jules, what can you tell us about that venue?
Yeah, it's obviously a very iconic place just before you arrive on the Champs-Élysées, so at the bottom of the Champs-Élysées, with the big obelisk. that was given obviously by Egypt a very, very long time ago. And there you will have the BMX, you will have the skateboards, the breakdance, which is making its debut at the 2024 Olympics, and the 3v3 basketball. Basketball is big in France. The 3v3 home men and women's team are European champions, for example. And it's quite a new, it's a new sport as well in the Olympics. I think it's only the second time that they're there. But yeah, we expect a lot of people to be coming there and watch all the sports on this big Place de la Concorde, which is, like I said, near the Tuileries, near the Louvre and the Champs-Élysées, the bottom of the Champs-Élysées.
We've got to mention the Eiffel Tower Stadium. Whenever something is going to take place in Paris, you're going to think about how they can make the most of the Eiffel Tower. There's going to be sport taking place there as well.
Yeah, so the Champs-Élysées, you will have the judo, the wrestling and the beach volleyball, which they really wanted to play there, because I think it's, like you said, Rob, this so iconic. Again, it's never easy. For example, basketball, I'm not happy that some of the games will be played outside of Paris in Lille, because it just... there was too many sports and almost not enough venue to make it work completely. So sometimes it's a bit of a battle to find who plays where, what sport goes where, because I think a lot of sports wanted to be at the Eiffel Tower because for them it was the best publicity around the Olympics. Imagine if whatever sport you have, especially the minor sport, if we can call it like that, having those photos and that footage at the bottom of the Eiffel Tower, it was very special. So in the end, judo, who is massive in France, of course, wrestling and beach volley are the three that are going to take place at the Eiffel Tower.
You know how I'm really selfless when it comes to this podcast, Emma. I think on behalf of Sport 24, I'm going to put myself out. It's not what I want to do. It's not my idea. I'm forcing myself to do this. But if Sport 24 need a surfing correspondent, I'm quite happy to put myself up for that one. Because
I thought you were going to volunteer yourself for beach volleyball at the Eiffel Tower, actually. But yes, either way.
Surfing for Paris 2024 is in Tahiti. So I'm willing to take one for the team. I'm quite happy to go out there should you want to go.
Just coming back to basketball, Jules, we're touching it towards the start of the pod as well. There seems to be a real first sort of appetite with the NBA as well. So what can you tell us more about the basketball scene?
Yeah, it's a big sport in France and in Paris especially. Maybe a top five for sure with football, rugby and tennis. But yeah, so recently the NBA has been refurbishing a lot of the basketball playgrounds you can find. So outdoors in Paris, there's one in the 11th arrondissement, Philippe Auguste, if you want to check it, it's really good. You've got another one at GMAP, the tube station, Charles Moureux as well. And there's a really, really good playground, that the latest one that the NBA has refurbished in the 20th arrondissement at Luquet, which is lovely. You can go and play, you don't have to pay. If people are already playing there, you can join their team, you can form a team yourself and wait for the first one to lose, and then you go in and play the winner. It's very open, it's very good. And again, they've made those very special, so the material is all good. And the vibe, usually the atmosphere, is pretty special as well.
Which teased me up to say, you can watch the NBA on Sport 24. So Jules, when you're not in Paris playing basketball, I know you spend a lot of time in the air, don't you? Make sure you can tune in to Sport 24.
Exactly.
And you can watch the NBA there.
Perfect.
And when we're talking about some of the other sports that are going to be taking place in Paris 2024, Versailles is going to play a big part as well.
Yeah, so again, slightly outside of Paris itself and the city centre, if you want, or the capital, is, I would say, 45-minute drive west. It's obviously very famous for the castle, and you can visit it if you like those kind of things. But also, you can go there and watch the pentathlon and all the like horses competition. If you want, all the equestrian will be at Versailles. I think President Macron, who is a big fan of the Chateau de Versailles, really wanted something there as well. It makes sense because obviously, you know, Versailles and Paris are. Like Versailles is almost part of Paris, so to again showcase all the great things that Paris has to offer, if you can go to Versailles and have a couple of competitions there, it's very special. And if you haven't been to see the castle, it's something really that you have to do, because it's an amazing place.
Now, Paris is also home to one of the world's most prestigious horse races, run at the Longchamps course in Paris. The Arc de Triomphe is another must visit event hosted in October each year.
My name's Rafe Beckett. I train at Kempton Down near Andover in Hampshire. We train around 145 horses.
But out clear of the field is Westover, running upwards to finish. Westover is a triumph. champion jockey Colin Kane and Ralph Beckett in the Irish Derby wins by a huge margin.
Westover ran in the Ark last year. He finished an honourable sixth on ground that was very soft. His form is very solid and we're very much looking forward to taking him to Longchamp for the Ark.
Westover, Baybridge on the far side, inside the final furlong. A brilliant turn of foot. What acceleration.
Most English flat trainers would say that the race they most want to win is the Derby. However, perhaps from a business point of view, winning the Arc de Triomphe would be as important. It is the all-age championship. Difference between the two, of course, is that you can run in the Arc more than once, as Westover is. You can only run in the Derby as a three-year-old, as Westover did when he was third last year. But to win an Arc as a £5 million race is extremely important to all concerned.
It's the Qatar Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe of 2023 and thereof.
Certainly the racecourse stables at both the Saint-Cloud and Longchamp would be in excellent condition. There's two walking rings inside the sort of quadrangle courtyard type arrangement that you have. So that's how they work, and it's they're well laid out and well ventilated boxes.
Ace Impact, the ace in the pack in the Arc, and Ace Impact has won it in tremendous style.
So Longchamp on Arc weekend is a fantastic place to be. I'd recommend it to anybody who's thinking of going. The Irish and English element of the crowd there really make the day. The place is buzzing. Anybody going there at that time of year, obviously Paris is a wonderful place to be in the autumn, and Longchamp is a wonderful to go racing, certainly since they've revamped the whole grandstand in recent years. So it's a wonderful place and I'd recommend it strongly to anybody.
Jules, just give us an idea of how big this event is.
Yeah, this is the place where you want to be seen. Even if you don't like horse racing and you don't bet or you don't do anything, you know nothing about it, this is where a big crowd gather. Of course, it's a very special occasion. It's considered as the biggest race in horse racing in the world. People come from really far away. And we mentioned a little bit through the show about the culture historically of horse racing in Paris. You've got in Longchamp, obviously, in Chantilly, not too far outside of the city. In Auteuil, there's another one. In Vincennes, there's one as well. So all around the city and inside the city, you've got those horse racing courses, mm-hmm. race, yeah, that you can go and enjoy. The food is usually very good as well. And it's usually quite easy to get in, apart from, again, L'Arc de Triomphe, where you have to organise yourself quite early to get tickets.
I love how you check English words with me and Emma. I'm not sure we're the greatest representatives of the English language.
We appreciate
it. Halfway through my sentence, yeah.
We appreciate it. Whenever we talk about sport, we mentioned this right at the start of the podcast. We talked about the Tour de France and that the ending for that is just always unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. And if you've watched on television or if you've been lucky enough to go there, there's obviously the loop all around the Arc de Triomphe at the top of the Champs-Élysées, and then they go back down again. They go near the Tuileries, they go under the tunnel, and then they go back again up alongside those famous hotels, Le Meurice, for example, and then go back up on the Champs-Élysées until they finish that stage. The Tour de France always starts in a different place every year. However, he always finishes on the Champs-Élysées, and this is the one stage, especially if you're a sprinter, that you dream of winning all your life, really all your career.
Well, I have to say, the whole podcast has been a bit of an education, Jules, certainly when it comes to the linguistics. So on that, just to wrap up, do you have a kind of local word or piece of slang? I think, Rob, actually, you might have created some slang in some of your delivery of the French in this podcast just by accident. But are there any words you can give us that if we're on the ground in Paris, we can use and make us sound a bit more local?
Yes.
Yeah, so, and I know the bar's low, but...
No, it's not that. But it's one that is really easy for you to remember and for all the listeners to remember. Another name for Paris is, and that's the slang of the city, is called Paname. So if you say, I'm going to Paname, everybody understand that you're going to Paris. So, you know, you can put it, I love Paname, like I love Paris. You know, I miss Paris, I miss Paname if you want. But Paname is a really cool word, another word to say Paris.
So Paname, I've never heard that. Do you know its origins? Where does it come from?
So apparently it comes at the beginning of the 20th century when, you know, the Panama hats, a lot of very elegant men in Paris were wearing it. And Paris was considered, and still considered as the city for elegance and very elegant people there. So it apparently came from that.
Very I don't even know what to say after that.
I was going to make a jab at Rob, but I feel like I've been going for everyone a bit on this podcast. I was going to say elegance, no, Rob. Get yourself to Paris. Yeah. Yeah, surely you've got a Panama hat in your wardrobe, haven't you, Rob, with all the travelling you do to exotic places?
There might be one somewhere, but it's not something I can reach for straight away, if I'm completely honest with you. Before, I know we're coming towards the end of the podcast, can I just make a point of saying that Jules goes straight in at the top of the list of voices and accents that I could quite happily hear read the phone book, because his voice is that good. Have you ever thought, dude, by doing a podcast series, just reading bedtime stories, Jules, because I would download it.
Good to know. Thank you.
It has been soothing, and sadly, we are coming towards the end of the podcast. But before we wrap things up, what would be your recommendation, your favourite place to eat in Paris? Which, yeah, I imagine, yeah, it's quite a tricky question, isn't it? You're spoilt for choice, really.
Yeah, there's a few. I would say the Georges, which is at the top of the Georges Pompidou Centre in Châtelet, where you get a great view of the whole city. But maybe right now the best is Giraffe. Not Giraffe as in the chain of restaurant that you can have in the UK, but the Giraffe in Paris, where the terrace gives you an amazing view of the Eiffel Tower.
I'm sure I've seen that before. Isn't that used on a really famous Instagram picture with Leo Messi?
Exactly. I think that's one of the restaurants address that PSG gave to the Messi family to go to was the Giraffe one. So if it's good for the Messi, it's good for you and Emma to go. Yeah.
There's like an amazing photograph with the Eiffel Tower right behind him. Is that right?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Do you hear that? If it's good enough for Messi, Rob, it's good enough for you and me. I think there's only one way to find out how good it is, really, and that's by going there in person,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's just about it from Paris. The City of Love is certainly one of the biggest sporting cities in the world. So if you're travelling soon, check out Sport24's live sports schedule at sport24live.com to make sure you won't miss any of the biggest sporting events live in the air or at sea. Sport24 really does have it all. So it just leaves me to say a huge thank you to all of my guests, to Julien Laurent, for expertly guiding us through Paris. Julien, merci.
Thank you for having me.
And of course, Rob, my trusty TikToking travel companion. Au revoir.
If nothing else, I will remember the one thing, which is lunch is very important in Paris.
Well, do make sure you subscribe to the pod to hear more trips of our travels to other sporting cities such as Melbourne, Miami and London. And we're back very soon exploring destinations like New York, Dubai and Doha. But from me, Emma Saunders, and the On Tour with Sport24 gang, it's goodbye, and until next time, safe travels.